The incident came back to me as I sat in my room in St. John's Wood, reading Black's Veterinary Dictionary. It was a bulky volume to carry around, and my RAF friends used to rib me about my vest pocket edition, but I resolved to keep reading it in spare moments to remind me of my real life. I had reached the letter C, and as the word castration looked up at me from the page, I was jerked back to Rory. I was castrating pigs. There were several litters to do, and I was in a hurry and failed to notice the Irish farm worker's mounting apprehension. His young boss was catching the little animals and handing them to Rory, who held them upside down, gripped between his thighs with their legs apart, and as I quickly incised the scrotums and drew out the testicles, my blade almost touched the rough material of his trouser crutch.
"For God's sake, have a care, Mr. Harriet,"
he gasped at last. I looked up from my work. "What's wrong, Rory?"
"Watch what you're doing with that bloody knife. You're whipping it round between my legs like a bloody Red Indian. You'll do me a mischief before you're finished."
"Ah, be careful, Mr. Harriet," the young farmer said. "Don't geld Rory instead of the pig. His missus would never forgive you." He burst into a loud peal of laughter. The Irishman grinned sheepishly, and I giggled. That was my undoing, because the momentary inattention sent the blade slicing across my left forefinger. The razor-sharp edge went deep, and in an instant the entire neighbourhood seemed flooded with my blood. I thought I would never staunch the flow. The red ooze continued, despite a long session of self-doctoring from the car boot, and when I finally drove away, my finger was swathed in the biggest, clumsiest dressing I'd ever seen. I had finally been forced to apply a large pad of cotton wool held in place with an enormous length of 3-inch bandage. It was dark when I left the farm. About 5 o'clock on a late December day, the light gone early and the stars beginning to show in a frosty sky. I drove slowly, the enormous finger jutting upwards from the wheel, pointing the way ahead between the headlights like a guiding beacon. I was within 1/2 mile of Derby, with the lights of the little town beginning to wink between the bare roadside branches, when a car approached, went past, then I heard a squeal of brakes as it stopped, and began to double back. It passed me again, drew me into the side, and I saw a frantically waving arm. I pulled up, and a young man jumped from the driving seat and ran towards me. He pushed his head in at the window.
"Are you the vet?"
His voice was breathless, panic-stricken.
"Yes, I am." "Oh, thank God. We're passing through on the way to Manchester, and we've been to your surgery. They said you were out this way, described your car. Please help us."
"What's the trouble?"
"It's our dog. In the back of the car. He's got a ball stuck in his throat. I think he might be dead."
I was out of my seat and running along the road before he had finished. It was a big white saloon, and in the darkness of the back seat, a wailing chorus issued from several little heads silhouetted against the glass. I tore open the door, and the wailing took on words.
"Oh, Benny, Benny, Benny!"
I dimly discerned a large dog spread over the knees of 4 small children.
"Oh, Daddy, he's dead! He's dead!"
"Let's have him out," I gasped. And as the young man pulled on the forelegs, I supported the body, which slid and toppled onto the tarmac with a horrible limpness. I pawed at the hairy form. "I can't see a bloody thing. Help me pull him round." We dragged the unresisting bulk into the headlight's glare, and I could see it all. A huge, beautiful collie in his luxuriant prime, mouth gaping, tongue lolling, eyes staring lifelessly at nothing. He wasn't breathing. The young father took one look, then gripped his head with both hands. "Oh, God, oh, God!" From within the car, I could hear the quiet sobbing of his wife and the piercing cries from the back.
"Benny, Benny!"
I grabbed the man's shoulder and shouted at him.
"What did you say about the ball?"
"It's in his throat. I've had my fingers in his mouth for ages, but I couldn't move it." The words came mumbling out from beneath the bent head. I pushed my hand into the mouth, and I could feel it all right. A sphere of hard, solid rubber, not much bigger than a golf ball, and jammed like a cork in the pharynx, effectively blocking the trachea. I scrabbled feverishly at the wet smoothness, but there was nothing to get hold of. It took me about 3 seconds to realize that no human agency would ever get the ball out that way, and, without thinking, I withdrew my hands, braced both thumbs behind the angle of the lower jaw, and pushed. The ball shot forth, bounced on the frosty road, and rolled sadly onto the grass verge. I touched the corneal surface of the eye, no reflex. I slumped to my knees, burdened by the hopeless regret that I hadn't had the chance to do this just a bit sooner.
The only function I could perform now was to take the body back to Skeldale House for disposal. I couldn't allow the family to drive to Manchester with a dead dog. But I wished fervently that I'd been able to do more. And as I passed my hand along the richly coloured coat over the ribs, the vast bandaged finger stood out like a symbol of my helplessness. It was when I was gazing dully at the finger, the heel of my hand resting in an intercostal space, that I felt the faintest flutter from below. I jerked upright with a hoarse cry.
His heart's still beating! He's not gone yet!
I began to work on the dog with all I had. Out there in the darkness of that lonely country road, it wasn't much. No stimulant injections, no oxygen cylinders, no intratracheal tubes. But I depressed his chest with my palms every 3 seconds in the old-fashioned way, willing the dog to breathe as the eyes still stared at nothing. Every now and then I blew desperately down the throat, or probed between the ribs for that almost imperceptible beat. I don't know which I noticed first, the slight twitch of an eyelid, or the small lift of the ribs which pulled the icy Yorkshire air into his lungs. Maybe they both happened at once, but from that moment everything was dreamlike and wonderful. I lost count of time as I sat there while the breathing became deep and regular, and the animal began to be aware of his surroundings. And by the time he started to look around him and twitch his tail tentatively, I realized suddenly that I was stiff-jointed and almost frozen to the spot. With some difficulty I got up and watched in disbelief as the collie staggered to his feet. The young father ushered him round to the back, where he was received with screams of delight. The man seemed stunned. Throughout the recovery he had kept muttering, "You just flicked that ball out, just flicked it out. Why didn't I think of that?" And when he turned to me before leaving, he appeared to be still in a state of shock. I don't know how to thank you," he said huskily. "It's a miracle." He leant against the car for a second. "And now, what is your fee? How much do I owe you?" I rubbed my chin. I had used no drugs. The only expenditure had been time. "5 bob, I said. "And never let him play with such a little ball again." He handed the money over, shook my hand, and drove away. His wife, who had never left her place, waved as she left, but my greatest reward was in the last shadowy glimpse of the back seat, where little arms twined around the dog, hugging him ecstatically, and in the cries, thankful and joyous, fading into the night.
"Benny! Benny! Benny!"